Today on Straight Talk Africa, the politics of organizing and holding elections in Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali, and today we are discussing the politics of organizing and holding free and fair elections in Africa, and we're examining whether it is possible to have peace without a reliable democratic system of electing leaders in Africa. For an update on Sunday's elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo, joining me from Kinshasa is my VOA colleague, Abdurahman Dia. Good evening, Abdu.
Good evening, Shaka.
Now, given that we've been getting reports suggesting that the electoral body seems to be pretty much shifting goalposts, how sure are you and your colleagues that come Sunday, the election will indeed go ahead?
It's very hard to answer that question. At this point, all of the colleagues that I have been talking to are saying that anything can happen. And come Friday, even Saturday, we should always expect something from the election commission, given that the past few weeks or few days, they have been giving us so much information, conflicting information sometimes. Last week they delayed it, the election for a week, giving us the fire at the warehouse as a main reason. But they, if you notice, they did also talk about Ebola in the eastern part, as well as the inter-community clashes in Yumbi in the western part. But they decided that they would not go ahead without Kinshasa. Now that Kinshasa has its electoral material, they came out today saying that, well, indeed, Ebola in the eastern part and these clashes, which have caused many people to be displaced, including the electoral personnel. So for those reasons, they cannot organize the election in those two parts of the country. But what that means is that 1.2 million people will not be able to choose their next president.
How do they reconcile today's announcement with the fact that the last time I checked, candidates have in fact been campaigning all the time in those particular areas?
Absolutely. And that is actually what they are saying today. They are saying that the Election Commission had no problem with them campaigning there and drawing big crowds. And if you think about it, the crowds during an epidemic like Ebola is even more dangerous than the voting day, because during the day of the voting, people don't gather. So those people just don't understand why today has all of a sudden become a problem.
You know, as well as I do, of course, that this election we are talking about was expected to actually be done 2016, correct?
Right.
So any particular reason, frankly, why the electoral body is not ready to play ball at this time?
Well, it's also a hard question because they have been saying that they were ready all along, and they refused international aid, saying that this is a matter of sovereignty and they had the means to organize the election. So everybody would expect them to actually be ready. But it looks like, at least from what we are seeing, it's hard to say that they are fully ready. And at this point where we are is that the election is going to go ahead on Sunday without those three localities, Beni, Butembo, and Yumbi. But who knows what will happen by then.
Is it true, as we have heard through various reports, that one of the major opposition candidates, Felix Tshisekedi, is on record saying, despite today's statement from the electoral body of postponing elections in some specific areas in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, he will go ahead and participate in Sunday's vote?
Right. What we have is actually one of his closest aides who were taking part in a meeting with the Electoral Commission when he came out that UDPS official actually did say that regardless, they will still go to the polls on Sunday and that they will not give the opportunity to the Electoral Commission to say that the opposition has boycotted the election. So some are criticizing them on social media, saying that, you know, they are accepting that 1.2 million people will be excluded. But the reasoning, I think, for UDPS is to say that, you know, let's go to the end and so they can at least acknowledge that they are not ready. Because if we start boycotting, then maybe they can just go ahead and organize a chaotic election. And actually, the term chaotic election has been used yesterday by Martin Fayulun and seven other candidates. But what they want, the Electoral Commission is trying to do is basically install chaos and proclaim the candidate of the coalition, the presidential coalition, the winner in that chaos. Fayulu himself has tweeted, basically saying that this is not acceptable. But so far, they are still searching to see. They are promising tomorrow more information on how they are planning to go ahead with this.
Have you heard some reports suggesting that Felix Tshisekedi may in fact have cut a deal with the authorities?
We cannot confirm that, but yes, some are saying that. Whether it's true or not, it is true that he has a more conciliatory tone than Martin Fayulu. But one of my colleagues who lives here and who is very politically savvy has been telling me that he's almost like his father, Etienne Tshisekedi, who basically was a very strong opposition leader, but when he had to, then he would try to find common ground and discuss with the authorities. That is something that he probably took from his father. Whether now he had cut a deal in secret, at this point we don't know yet.
Abdu, what is the mood like from your vantage point? Does it look in any way at all that come Sunday there could in fact be an election?
Some people really don't. They seem tired of all this. So is the motivation going to be there come Sunday? Probably, if there are elections, people will definitely come out. But they are kind of, you know, saying, well, maybe there will be not elections, or who knows what can happen. And when you talk to people, they just want to get this over with. And it's been going on for so long, 2 years. They just don't know what to expect at this point.
When you talk to the people that you have interacted with, do you get the sense, Abdu, that people have confidence in the ability of the electoral body to carry out a free, fair, and credible election?
The people I have talked to, most of them know. But if you talk to the officials or those who are with the FCC, the Presidential Candidates Coalition, they will tell you they have faith in CENI. But the people I have talked to really do not have trust in the institution, but maybe it's because Kinshasa is mainly usually on the opposition side. I haven't seen someone who is not a supporter, unless you're involved in politics and you are supporting the government. those people that I've talked to on the street, they just, you know, want more clarity, actually. They just want a clear message from CENI, and they don't seem like they're getting it.
Well, on that note, Abdu, thank you very much for that update. And Abdurrahman reporting, of course, from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. And do take care of yourself, please.
Take care.
You're most welcome. Let's now hear from two Congolese citizens who are just trying to get by amid the political turmoil.
Shida za wakongomani ziko mingi.
The problems of the Congolese are innumerable, but the main ones are we have no security, no justice, no education, and healthcare is expensive, and we have no roads and no means of transport. The Congolese are still trying to make a living.
I encounter a lot of problems every day, such as access to water and poor road condition. Very often, when I leave home to go to university, getting there is not easy, and the cost of transportation is high.
And joining us in the studio today are two distinguished guests, Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and my VOA colleague, multimedia journalist, Ibrahim Garba. Well, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have another opportunity to interact with you on Straight Talk Africa.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
You're most welcome. To be honest with you, the audience missed you a lot, and as the host, missed you enormously, because I thought the last time we had a deal that we would, in fact, have to do a show reflecting your exit from the State Department.
It came a little prematurely, but I have not exited Africa. I'm still very much engaged and interested and looking forward to what is happening on the continent.
Well, very interesting. And, of course, Ibrahim Garba.
Thank you for having me.
This is the first time I have had the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Now, when you talk about Ibrahim Garba, you remind me of a former foreign minister of Nigeria, yeah, Brigadier General Joseph Garba.
Yeah, Garba is a commander, especially in northern Nigeria.
Really?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah, Garba is a short form of Abu Bakr.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So in northern Nigeria, if you want to call somebody that is known as Abu Bakr by name, you can just say Garba.
Garba.
Yeah.
That's now, nice.
Yeah, thank you.
It's very interesting, Ibrahim, that you come from Nigeria.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that very, very important, in fact, hugely important elections are around the corner.
Exactly.
In your country.
Yeah. But indications are that the 2019 election is less likely to be created by violence in view of the fact that Nigerians have been exposed to much political enlightenment. And another condition has been created whereby the two candidates, that is of the major parties, that is the incumbent, Alhaji Muhammadu Buhari and Atiku Abubakar, who is the candidate of the main opposition party, are both of the same House of Fulani extraction.
Mm-hmm.
They are both Muslims. They are both from northern Nigeria. So there is less likely to experience, that is for the election to experience violence as a result of religious, regional, and ethnic differences.
What about the credibility of that election? Yeah, do you think that we are going to probably see another election like we saw in 2015 under Professor Atahir Muhammadu Jega?
Yeah. Before I come to that, Siaka, let me just mention or take note of the fact that in addition to the nature of the two candidates, if you observe in 2011, over 800 Nigerians were killed in post-election violence. And in 2011, only about 100 Nigerians were killed in post-election violence. And the atmosphere then were much more alarming than now. So that is why I say there are two factors, one of which is the political enlightenment, in addition to the nature of the candidates. And coming back to what you said about the credibility of the two candidates, that is an important factor too, because, you know, corruption is the main problem of Nigeria, just like any other African nation. And Buhari is seen, rightly or wrongly, as the most transparent of all the major political, all the candidates, that is, major candidates. There are, you know, other candidates, but Atiku and Buhari are the main candidate, and Buhari is considered to be so, like I said, rightly or wrongly, because you can hardly link him to any major scandals in the country, you know? And so Buhari is likely to campaign on transparency and anti-corruption.
How has he done far, though?
But Atiku is likely to campaign on, like, economic growth and political experience. So, and both of which are important.
Why would Atiku Abubakar not campaign on the platform of curbing corruption?
Yeah, like I told you, there are some allegations hanging on his neck, rightly or wrongly, because I'm not in the position to substantiate such allegation.
Are those associated, for example, with a former U.S. congressman?
Exactly, Jefferson.
Jefferson.
Halliburton. You know, there are things
from Louisiana.
Like that. Exactly. So, in fact, it is alleged that he can come to United States of America in view of such allegations.
What about the issue of security?
Yeah.
We're talking about Boko Haram.
Yeah,
There was a time when incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari had in fact declared that that particular aspect of the war had actually been, in his words, not mine, technically, over.
Exactly. Well, that was based on the information available to him. And in fact, many Nigerians asked at that time, because in addition to what Buhari said, many other Nigerians, that is, important personalities, were saying that the war against Boko Haram was on the verge of being defeated. So it was based on that. But eventually, especially of recent, we have seen that Boko Haram is much alive. But actually, it has been dealt with to a very great extent. In view of the fact that, you know, this is an international terrorist organization, and nobody has been able to pinpoint the source of Boko Haram's funding. You know, nobody has been able to pinpoint those behind Boko Haram. It's like they have agents even in strategic aspect of the government and even private individuals. So it is very difficult to credit Buhari with failure to defeat Boko Haram. In fact, Boko Haram predates his administration.
What about the issue of the economy? Because, in fact, there are some people who say when it comes to Nigeria, sincerely, you are probably looking at the economy being stupid.
Exactly. Good that you have brought this issue, which is very important. In fact, many Nigerians are saying that Buhari had promised to free them from the economic wars they found themselves, but he has failed. But some are also saying that such people that are making such observation have failed to take into consideration the fact that at that time, all the countries that were relying on oil, even Saudi Arabia, had to abandon the use of Islamic calendar in order to have enough resources, because Islamic calendar is longer than the Gregorian calendar. Mm-hmm. Naturally, Saudi Arabia should be the one to be at the forefront of promoting Islamic calendar. So any economic situation that would make Saudi Arabia abandon Islamic calendar would make Nigeria, you know, go on its knee. So Buhari is not supposed to be blamed, according to some people, for the economic woes of Nigeria, because it was a global issue. There was fall in oil price, which, in fact, he had no power over. But Atiku is considered by some people to be somebody who is capable of bringing foreign investors because of his ability to interact. That's what some people say. He is more reliable when it comes to economic growth plans. That they say that he has that as compared to Buhari, who is banking on his transparency and anti-corruption agenda, both of which, like I told you before, are very important when it comes to Nigerians' survival.
What about some other reports from some Nigerians who say that when you actually give the opportunity to Atiku Abubakar to occupy Aso Rock in Abuja, that he could probably mortgage Nigeria?
Exactly. There is such fears in view of the antecedents of the great politician. Because in the past, he was associated with, you know, failure to transparently sell public asset. Some people were arguing that he kind of mortgaged such asset, kind of ensure that they were literally handed over to his friends. Whether such allegations are true or not, I don't know. But such allegations are very pronounced in within the political cycle. That he, what they are saying is that Nigerian problem is not much of economic plans. So his political agenda or political growth plan will hardly fly, because they are saying that if you fight corruption in Nigeria, you have done what Nigerians need, because all other things will follow. So that's how the things stand as of now.
What about the issue of President Buhari's health situation?
Yeah, that's another important factor. Especially when Buhari, you know, was reported to have been hospitalized on several occasions.
In the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So there was that fear that Buhari would not be able or would not be able to govern very well.
How is he now?
Yeah, now he is appreciably okay.
How could you possibly say that, Ibrahim, when there are reports, you know as well as I do, that in fact we are not perhaps looking at President Buhari,
Buhari.
We are actually looking at an imposter called Jibril from Sudan.
Yeah, but do you believe that? I know we are living in a modern time. Do you believe that such, we have, of course we are scientifically advanced, but do you believe that such thing happened?
We have to look at the evidence.
I doubt you believe that.
Have you seen him? Have you talked to him?
I haven't talked to him, but of recent, Ali Mustafa talked to him.
And I met with him recently.
Very good.
You see, another issue I believe you would want to bring up is the issue of his age. Some people say he's too old and so on.
He's but in his 70s.
Yeah, he's 75, but Atiku is 71.
That is almost the average age of, presidents of the continent.
Yeah, he's 75, Atiku is 71. A difference of 4 years. In the life of a president, a difference of 4 years doesn't really matter. To some people, it matters. To some people, it doesn't. To some people. So I don't know how we are going to evaluate that.
Very interesting. Let me come to you, Ambassador Plenipotential Extraordinary.
Well, thank you.
You just got back from Nigeria.
I did.
In fact, the last time we were talking on telephone, you told me you were, was it in Lagos?
I was in Abuja.
In Abuja, yes.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Did you actually get the opportunity to meet with incumbent Nigerian president, Major General Muhammadu Buhari, retired but certainly not tired?
I did meet with President Buhari,
mm-hmm.
and had a good conversation with him that was put on local TV.
Did you take some pictures or video with him?
I did.
Really?
I did.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
How did he look like?
He looked great.
He looked
great. He looked fine. He looked healthy.
Mm-hmm.
He looked like Buhari.
He did.
I don't want to
certainly not
participate
like
in the...
Like Jibril.
He didn't. I don't know who Jibril is or what Jibril looks like, but the person I met with was the same President Buhari that I had met with previously in Nigeria.
Now, you obviously know him because you met him several times, especially in your previous capacity
mm-hmm.
as the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. You talk to us about why you were there.
I was asked by NDI,
mm-hmm.
the National Democratic Institute, to lead a joint delegation of NDI
mm-hmm.
and IRI to do a pre-election assessment of Nigeria.
And what is your report card so far?
There was a public press release that we sent out, and we also had a press conference in Nigeria last Wednesday. And we outlined some of the concerns that were raised by stakeholders with whom we met. We met with civil society. We met with about four or five of the different parties. I did have the opportunity to meet with Abubakar Atiku
mm-hmm.
And his team. And there is a sense among the various stakeholders of concern about the preparations for the election. But we also had an opportunity to engage with the independent Nigerian Electoral Commission, and I was impressed with the amount of preparation that they have made to move forward with the election. You know, Nigeria set a really high standard in 2015.
Too much.
it was good.
Yes.
It was a good election. It was considered free and fair, and it led to a transition from the ruling party to an opposition candidate. And it doesn't get any better than that. So the standard that Nigeria set was extraordinarily high. And it's our hope that Nigeria will continue to move in that direction as they make the preparations for the election moving forward. When I met with President Buhari, one of the things he said is that he will not treat the opposition in the same way that he was treated when he was running.
How was he treated when he was
running? I think he felt, I can't speak for him, but I think he felt that he was disadvantaged because he was in the opposition.
Then how did he end up winning?
Certainly because it was a free and fair process, and the Electoral Commission was well prepared. And it's our hope that that will be the case this time around as well.
Was it because of the Independent National Electoral Commission, or was it in fact because of one particular individual, the chairman at the time, Professor Atahiru Muhammadu Jega?
Certainly, Professor Jega was a key player in the success of the election. But an election success can't ride on one individual. And there was tremendous work put into building the capacity of the institution. His leadership was important, but the institution, I think, came prepared to see us through a process that was very well executed.
We do have some evidence from another part of Africa, and that is Kenya, where, for example, the 2003, was it 2002, 2003 election under Samuel Kivuitu, was an incredibly great election. And after that, things changed completely.
Again, it does depend on both the institution and the person who's heading the institution. And I think in the case of Kenya, we saw some backtracking.
Very interesting. Well, unfortunately, Madam Ambassador, time happens not to be our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, and you can also watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Trade Talk Africa, what major events are likely to shape the continent in 2019? And what might this mean for the continent's 200 million people between 15 and 24 who want a better future? Will 2019 open new avenues of growth for Africa's youth? We'll discuss the issues on the next Trade Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing the politics of organizing and holding free and fair elections in Africa. My guest today is Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. I have to say, of course, as usual, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you one more time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much.
Where have you been? We haven't seen you in this studio for a very, very long time.
You haven't seen me in the studio because you haven't invited me. But I've been here in D.C. and very actively involved on Africa issues. Mm-hmm. I am teaching at Georgetown University.
Yes.
In the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. I'm doing a course on South Sudan.
You must be a great resource to those young students.
I hope so. And I have been doing some consulting work with Albright Stonebridge Group in their Africa practice. Mm. And I've made myself available for others who need me. So, as I mentioned earlier, NDI called, and I'm on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy.
Congratulations.
So I'm absolutely engaged on the continent and continue to watch things very closely.
And so you pretty much you are associated with those who continue perhaps to preach the gospel of democracy across the African continent.
I do preach the gospel of democracy. I am a solid believer that democracy is the best route to success and prosperity on the continent of Africa. That said, we have seen some trends over the past year or so that are worrisome, and we need to continue to work to make sure those trends don't overtake the successes that we've had on the continent.
If I remember correctly, I think a former great British, Democrat, former Prime Minister Winston Churchill once said something about democracy not really being the best form of government, except for all the others that we know of.
Well, democracy is a process, and it's a very murky process. It is not a straight line from A to Z.
It is a detour.
There are detours in the democratic process, and it's a rough road. But we know when democracy succeeds, we know what the results are. And the results are governments that are for the people, governments that are by the people, and governments that are of the people. And that is a show of success.
What about some who say that when it comes to really the vast majority of countries on the African continent, governments, in fact, are not necessarily for the people of the people by the people?
I think that that is the case in some countries on the continent, but we're seeing more and more countries where democracy is taking root and growing. And those are the countries that I think will show success. And again, with some backsliding, but always moving forward.
The reports I see, frankly, and the people I talk to seem to tell me that you are talking about governments which are for some people, by some people, for some people.
And that is the case in some countries in Africa, but not all countries in Africa. And we're seeing democracy grow. Afrobarometer, and I hear a lot of people quote Afrobarometer on this point, but they have done polls that show the vast majority of people in Africa want democracy. Mm. And we're seeing more and more that governments are adjusting. And they are breaking away, in some cases, from dictatorial long-term rulers. We've seen some positive examples where we're just beginning to see all of the fruits of democracy. I think Nigeria...
For example?
Well, Ghana.
Yes.
Ghana had an extraordinary election after Nigeria's election.
Mm-hmm.
The Gambia,
mm-hmm.
That had a long-term leader of 22 years, and he lost the election in what was a very transparent process, because literally they dropped marbles into a box. There's no anonymity in the vote. And people voted for the opposition candidate. President Yahya Jammeh was a little taken aback. He initially accepted the results, decided later that maybe he wouldn't accept the results. And we saw the community of neighbors come together and pressure him into accepting the will of the people. So I think it's a little country, but it's a great example of what happens when democracy flourishes.
And I think something is also happening in Madagascar, isn't it?
Madagascar, equally. I haven't seen the results of the election yet. Mm. I was trying to find out, but they had an extraordinarily good election as well. We're seeing some things happen in Ethiopia. It's not democracy in the same way that we understand democracy,
mm.
but we're seeing changes that are taking place that are positive, that are leading to a process that is more democratic and more of the people. We're seeing that happen as well in Angola. So there are some positive examples.
What was it like really on your watch?
There was tremendous enthusiasm for Africa. And I think that enthusiasm continues. I don't want to say it hasn't continued under the new assistant secretary, but we were engaged. We were engaged with every single African country, and we were engaged with their people. And for me, the most important element of our policy was that our policies touch people, and people understood that the U.S. was there and that we were on their side, whether we were preaching human rights, preaching democracy, encouraging governments to respect press freedoms and individual rights, the rights of the LGBTI community, the rights of women. These were all in our talking points as we engaged with African leaders, in addition to also pushing for good governance, pushing against corruption, encouraging governments to be more responsible to their people. And I enjoyed every minute of it. I enjoyed the successes. I mourned the failures, but I always felt like we could stand up and move forward again.
It's very interesting that what you pretty much talked about really was what is probably what is referred to as American values, really. We're talking about rule of law. We're talking about freedoms of expression, freedoms of assembly, freedoms of the media, freedoms of worship, and all that kind of stuff. But how do you respond to some critics who say, on the contrary, what America has actually done in recent history is sacrifice American values at the expense of promoting what it calls vital national security interests?
You know, there has been that change. We have a new administration, and the focus of the new administration is very different from the previous administration, where the focus is on what is in U.S. national interests. Now, what I have said to African governments in my recent conversations is that our policies are always in U.S. national interests. It's always a policy that is America with its other partners.
It's trade.
Yes.
It's access to resources.
Absolutely.
At the expense of people.
Not at the expense of people. It should not be at the expense of people. Let me just say that. Because access to resources also brings with it opportunities. Opportunities for jobs, opportunities for investment, opportunities for improved infrastructure. So we can look at this in both ways. I do very much appreciate a policy that is values-based, that talks about what is in the hearts of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is important to be in our foreign policy. It's less so now, and this is a point that I think I'm hearing particularly from civil society, from organizations that are involved with communities, that they want the U.S. to be actively engaged on these issues.
But when you look at the history of the U.S., when it comes to promoting democracy, it really doesn't look very good across the African continent. We can go to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be called Zaire.
Mm-hmm.
Under Mobutu Sese Seko was a banger. Surely that was not democracy.
You know, we have evolved. So I would not say that our policies during the Cold War period in particular, when we look at how we engage with Africa in the 1970s, in the 1960s, during the colonial period, that it was a policy that was value-based. It was a policy that looked at whether a country was with us or against us. We moved from that period. I think we started moving from that period with the visit of President Carter to Liberia in 1978.
And
I
Nigeria.
Happened to be a young student. I wasn't in the Nigeria part, but I was a young student in Liberia, and I happened to be there when President Carter came.
You're very lucky. And you actually returned to Monrovia at another time as U.S. ambassador.
I did. It was concentric circles. But I think beginning with that visit of President Carter to Africa, our policies started adjusting to bring into our approaches with Africa, one that shows the values of America and what it is that makes our country great.
Let's come to the Reagan administration, you're talking about constructive engagement with South African apartheid. Let's come to the Clinton administration. You're talking about an administration that talked and promoted the idea of the beacons of hope for African democracy, a new breed of African leaders, beginning with the Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia. You go down to Uganda, Yoweri Museveni. Yeah. You go to Rwanda and what have you, and now you continue even with the subsequent presidents, and you look, for example, at the Great Lakes region. Where is democracy?
I think it is an evolving concept, and our policies toward Africa evolved. Nothing was perfect. We're still paying for constructive engagement in South Africa. The South Africans have not fully forgiven our policies, despite the fact that we were so active from a people standpoint in the anti-apartheid movement. So there were some policy issues that I think all of us feel badly that we were not on the right side of history. But when I think it's all added up at some point at the pearly gates, we will see that our policies of promoting democracy and promoting human rights and promoting values really stands out.
What about critics who talk about, for example, you've actually been endorsing elections that are fake in their view, elections whose results are frankly reflections not of the will of the people, but rather the will of the people who count the votes?
Well, you know, let me just say this. Elections have become a way of leaders giving leaders some justification for their rule. It's accepted by even people who are not good leaders and people who don't believe in democracies. And so we don't have perfect elections. But I think eventually we will get to that point. If we look at elections in Nigeria before 2015, they left a lot to be desired. We look at some of the local elections. They have left a lot to be desired. But what is consistent in all of those elections is the will of the people to vote. And you see people lined up in Africa because they still believe. And I think we have to make a commitment to bring that belief into a reality.
The people
for them
are not the problem.
The people are not the problem.
The problem are the rulers. I
absolutely agree with you.
So what do you do about that? Because let's face it, for example, there was a time when most African countries were probably being ruled by AK-47, military coups. But the international community drew lines in the sand and said, we are not going to do business with you as usual if you seize power with AK-47.
And we don't see that anymore.
But why don't we also perhaps extend it to the situation of elections actually becoming elections rather than selections?
I think we
changing constitutions, really.
I actually think we are moving to that point. It's slower than saying we're not going to support you if you come into power by the barrel of a gun. But we are saying to leaders that we will not engage with you if you are involved in situations that punish your people or where you are being dictators. And so we're seeing those governments change. If you look at our MCC programs, we're giving Millennium Challenge compacts to countries that have met certain standards of democracy.
That's a very good policy, by the way.
It's absolutely a good policy. It's not as fast as we, you know, sometimes it's easy to say, let's just cut off a country. And when you cut off a country, you cut off its people. And so those decisions are very difficult to come by. You don't want to cut off people. You have to continue to sometimes engage with people you don't like and to engage with people you don't respect who are not carrying out policies that are in the interests of their people and not participating in good governance. But part of that is so that we can continue to engage with people, to have programs like PEPFAR that has had an amazing impact on the incidence of HIV/AIDS in Africa, or programs like the Malaria Initiative under the Bush administration. You want to continue to engage with people. And if you are engaging with people, you unfortunately sometimes have to engage with their governments.
It has really made a difference in terms of people suffering from malaria,
absolutely,
tuberculosis, and HIV/AIDS.
So you have to engage with leaders sometimes to reach their people. And that is why you will see us in countries engaging with countries that may not fit our concept of democracy and leaders who are not necessarily good leaders because of that. I look at the situation in South Sudan, for example, a country that we and many others around the globe participated in bringing to freedom in 2011. And then they end up going to war with each other. And the people who have suffered the most are the people of South Sudan. But can we cut off those people because we find their leaders unacceptable? It's a hard decision.
But according to some incontrovertible evidence, frankly, it is these rulers, really, essentially, who are exploiting their own people.
They are.
And can be seen, for example, in terms of the massive properties they own in neighboring countries and abroad.
It's a shame. It's embarrassing. And it is something we need to call them out on a regular basis. And we need African leaders, the neighboring countries, to call them out as well. Because many times the properties that they own are in the neighboring countries.
To what extent do those neighboring African leaders have what they call moral authority to actually do that?
It's not moral authority. It's commitment. It's moral commitment to do the right thing. And in many countries, we've not seen that commitment to call out their neighbors on some of the acts that are being committed.
You're talking about South Sudan. Do you sincerely know why they are fighting? This is an incredibly rich country.
Yeah.
A country with incredible opportunities, really. I have had the privilege and honor of overflowing that country twice. Mm. That country is incredibly fertile.
Yes.
It could be the breadbasket of the entire region and beyond.
Yes.
That country has very few people.
Yes.
They could actually get into the business of allowing immigrants to come and help them develop their country and their resources. But yet they are actually killing the few that they have. Why?
I think the answer is simple. It's leadership. It is leadership not committed to the people.
So there is a leadership deficit.
There's a leadership deficit. They're fighting for control over resources, but not fighting for the opportunity to bring prosperity to their people. And that is probably the saddest commentary that I can make on South Sudan.
But in fairness to South Sudanese leaders, really, or rulers, and in fairness to them, I would say that they probably didn't have a lot of positive role models around them, really.
They didn't.
Because when you think about the continent itself, part of the problem is probably what you just said, leadership deficit. Africa is busy helping other countries become superpower.
Well,
look at China, for example.
Yeah.
How does China become what it is today?
Yeah.
It's basically sitting on the shoulders of African resources.
That's absolutely true. But I think in the case of South Sudan, they had the opportunity to show the world that they were different.
Because you look at Khartoum. If you're in Juba, look at Khartoum.
Yeah.
You look at Bangui. You probably look at Kampala.
Yeah.
You look at Mogadishu.
And you shouldn't want to be like them.
You look at Addis Ababa.
You shouldn't want to be like them. But when we talk about this leadership deficit, it is still a lack of commitment to the people. And using young boys to fight for personalities. They're not fighting for goals. They're not fighting for reasons. They're fighting for personalities. They side with a person, and they're willing to kill for those individuals who are using their leadership skills for bad.
Madam Ambassador, what is it like being U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs?
At the moment, I don't know. I would ask...
tell us about...
A lot of sleepless nights. A lot of sleepless nights.
Can you walk us, for example, through a day in the life of Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Secretary of State for African Affairs?
When I was Assistant Secretary of State, I had very long days. I usually started my day at about 4 a.m. in the morning because Africa is 6-8 hours ahead. So if there were phone calls to be made to heads of state, to our ambassadors, to anyone on the continent, the best time for me to do it is early in the morning on at my time. So generally, I would wake up to make phone calls early in the morning. I usually would read emails from about 5 to 6, and then I would get dressed and go in to work at 7 o'clock in the morning and have my first meeting at 7:30. So by the time most people come in to work, I've already put in about four hours. And the day could be one in which I come in over to talk to you, or I give a speech. I'm signing a lot of papers. I'm still making a lot of phone calls. But in the back of my mind, every single day, I'm worried about the next crisis, because we had a number of crises when I was Assistant Secretary. Central African Republic, South Sudan War that started in December of 2013, my first few months in the job as Assistant Secretary. President Mandela died. That, for us, was took a great deal of time. But one of the most important events that took place, and it wasn't a crisis, but we worked in crisis mode, was 2014 Africa Leaders Summit that President Obama hosted, bringing all the African leaders to Washington.
Single most important decision that you made during your tenure, and what about single most regrettable decision?
Wow. I think in terms of decisions that I participated in, it was the decision by the Obama administration to host the African Leaders Summit. I think that the benefits of that summit are continuing to be reaped on the continent of Africa. I would say the decision that I regret the most as Assistant Secretary, there are a lot of them. I can't come up with a single one.
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. We'll have to deal with that next time. Okay. On that note, thanks to our guests today, Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, Abdulrahman Diye, and Ibrahim Gaba, who joined us earlier in the program. Thank you all for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.